Welcome to the A&N and After Show. It's me, Lindsay Loveridge, and with me is James Beckett.
Yo.
And we've got a packed little show for you guys. This evening, we're going to be talking about the movie Look Back, which had a limited run in theaters and throughout the U.S. And it's based on the Tatsuki Fujimoto single volume manga. I got a chance to see it. James got a chance to see The Freeway in an attempt to see it.
I'm so upset.
So we'll talk about that. We're going to talk about the Uzumaki episode 2 debacle. Man, we've been talking up Uzumaki for, I feel like, a year off and on this podcast. We talked about episode 1, which if you go back a couple, like last week, if you go back last week, it says Uzumaki is almost the perfect anime. That was the
almost is now doing just a lot of heavy lifting.
A lot of heavy lifting. For those of you just joining us, you're not late. You haven't missed anything. We're starting 15 minutes later than usual and may be doing that well into the future because my son has a club thing he does after school now and I got to pick him up and get here.
I was too busy crying about Look Back. I've been an inconsolable wreck.
Yeah. So we'll talk about Uzumaki and then we're going to talk about some of the best premieres so far this season. We had one day in there that was like packed with shows. So the fall anime season premieres have almost wrapped up. So I feel like we can, you know, talk about some of those, tell you which ones to check out, which ones not to. But before we get into that, I'm reminding you to please subscribe to this channel. You can find us on YouTube, X, and Facebook, and the audio version usually is now going up on Fridays on Anime News Network and all of your popular podcast streaming platforms. All right. So first, to talk about Look Back, James, do you want to tell us your Look Back tragedy story? Because people in the comments are thinking that your crying has to do with it being a poor
adaptation. With it being an emotionally affecting masterpiece of a film. That's what I've heard.
Yes.
I've heard so many. I was smart in that I immediately purchased my tickets the minute they went live, which was good because they were selling out all over the place, it sounds like. But then I was dumb in that however many weeks later, when the
it was a lot. I had to like look up in my inbox for my ticket. I was like, where is this?
You see, I have the Cinemark app because that's the theater that it's playing at in my city. Mm-hmm. And I go to the Cinemark all the time. I'm a subscriber. It's like my favorite place. Hashtag not a sponsor. And I looked at the app and, you know, at the top it said Cinemark, insert my zip code and around where I live here. And then I said Look Back showing at 4:15 p.m. or whatever time it was. And so I went, okay. We had another movie that we saw earlier in the day that my wife and I saw. We went home for a little bit, had some lunch, and then we kind of left just in time to get to the theater. You know, again, the theater I always go to, the theater that always has all of the showings. It's kind of the not the biggest theater in town, but it's in kind of like the central hub where it would make sense to do those little screenings because that's where most people are going to go. And then I go and I scan my tickets and they're like, oh, this ticket's not working, sir. I'm like, what are you talking about? I paid for it. And they go, well, it says it's actually at the Cinemark on the other side of town. And I look at it and I realize that that's exactly where it is. And because of afternoon Sunday traffic and the size of this stupid city I live in, it would have taken me a full half hour to get there, not including to like get in the door and find our seats. And by that point, the very short 57-minute film would have basically been over. So, yeah. Anyway, I will say I couldn't get a refund for my ticket because the movie was already starting.
So I am
happy to have supported Fujimoto and the filmmakers and the wonderful box office success that this movie seems to be having since they're adding more showings. And I'm going to hopefully try to catch one of those if I can.
Was the theater you were at, was their showing sold out? Could they not have
this is the one time. This is the theater I told you. They have the Don Don poster.
Yeah. Like,
in the marquee. They didn't even have Look Back playing.
Oh, man. Okay.
I know.
So it's not like you could have been like, well, I guess we'll just buy it or tickets or something. Yeah. Like, okay. Well, that is, I would have probably cried and it would have ruined my entire evening.
I was very angry, which in my case translated to me telling my wife, we're going to go to the Cold Stone right next to the theater.
And yes, that's not a complete waste, right?
I'm getting Halloween themed ice cream and I ate my sorrows. Yeah. But Lindsay, please tell me how wonderful it was.
Okay. So for those just now joining us, we're talking about the movie Look Back that opened in theaters in the US over the weekend. It was very a limited number of screenings, but it has so far done well. It's pulled in over a
million, right?
Like, yeah, I was gonna say over a million.
Hoping the anime industry helps bring back the culture of like local small cinema where these theaters can like, you know, stay alive and also show some cool shit that you wouldn't otherwise get to see.
Yeah, I know that there are new numbers out. It was estimated to have earned about 700,000 over the opening weekend, but Box Office Mojo is estimating its international earnings to be about 9.7 million. So we'll just keep an eye on that when the numbers come out. Again, it was a pretty limited screening, but oh man.
Now, when they say international, do they mean like completely outside of Japan or just overall?
I'm not sure. Box Office Mojo's international earnings include gross earnings from Colombia, Japan, South Korea, Hong Kong, and Vietnam.
And then, usually here, right, when we say international, we mean like outside of the US. I didn't know
right.
that, like, you know, everywhere but Japan or just.
This looks like they are, in fact, counting Japan. And I don't know how wide the release was there either, because as you said earlier, this is a 57-minute film. It's not considered like a full-length feature by most standards. When they showed it, they're also including interviews with the director and the voice actors at the end to kind of give you some more insight to it. This is a very emotionally deep film and it looks beautiful. I can't like overstate how wonderful the animation is throughout the entire thing. You know, I didn't cry, but I almost did, which is a high mark for emotional films for me. I don't cry very easily, except when it comes to like pretty certain topics. Yeah. And this one did get me because I think at the heart of Look Back and what a lot of people on social media are talking about, the heart of this film is both the dedication and hard work of being an artist, of artistic creators, of learning your craft, of putting that ahead of anything else in your life, just because you are so focused on wanting to improve and be the best artist that you can. And the other part of the film, I would say, is about grief. So it's especially about if you have someone that you both care about deeply as a friend and respect deeply creatively, and then they are gone, how about processing that?
Yeah.
So I don't know how into spoilers I should get for everybody. The screenings are mostly done in theaters, and it follows the manga's story very closely, but it adds all these wonderful embellishments to make it worth animating it versus just reading it. Like the vocal performances add a lot to it, like actually having the voices of Komodo and Fujino there. And there's all these things that the director, Oshiyama, added to kind of like, you know, go from one medium to another. The one that he cites in an interview I did with him at Anime Expo, you can read it on Anime News Network, is he talks about this scene of Fujino skipping in the rain. And that scene takes place immediately after her and Kyomoto meet for the first time. And Kyomoto pays her a compliment about her artistic ability. And they have both never met, but they've both been publishing like little kind of four panel comics in the school newspaper. They're in fourth grade, I think. No, this is sixth grade when they finally meet because they're about to graduate middle school. So they meet for the first time. And Fujino has been, you know, she was studying and studying and studying to get better and better at art, basically because of how good Kyomoto was when she saw her art in the newspaper. But it's just not reaching like the level that she wishes she was at, given how much effort she's put in and how much time. And so she's more or less started to give up. And then she meets Kyomoto for the first time, and Kyomoto basically like showers her with praise and tells her like, the comic strip that you published in this issue on this day is, you know, that one was one of my favorites. And also all the ones that followed this mini storyline and yada, yada, yada. And that's the first time where they discuss like making something together in the future. And then she skips all the way home in the rain and she's like, her, you can tell there's this tension in her body because she's just like pushing up because she's just skipping really hard because she's so excited. And she like reaches a hand down and like splashes a puddle that's next to her. And
so awesome.
She's making these like little ugly, funny faces because she's just like so full of motion. And all of that is in the film throughout its entirety.
I think it makes sense that, you know, this movie in particular would give the artists working on it the opportunity to channel that same passion for their craft, right? Like it would almost have to be, otherwise the story wouldn't be honest, right? Like
Right. And Oshiyama in the interview at the end actually talks about that, about how there's specific scenes in the film that he wanted it to connect back to the artists working on the film, so they're intentionally not as cleaned up as they would usually be for a professional production, because he wants you to see like the sort of outline line work at certain
point. That it's a made thing, right?
Yeah, that it's that like
people have to create with their
hands. Yes, yeah, and that was his way of sort of reflecting on that.
No, that's exactly one of my favorite movies is The Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Yeah, and some of my husband's favorite movies too.
And Wes Anderson talks about how one of his favorite things about it is that because they're working with puppets that are covered in fur, that there was no way for them to avoid the traces of like the fingers on the hair, like just, you know, the hair as they're moving the models. And he said he was glad that it ended up staying in there because it reminded you that these things had to be moved by people. And that like, even though, you know, it's magic that you're being tricked into, you know, your brain is kind of being tricked into following these, you know, 24 frames per second of still images of puppets. I think that's why I love like Tokusatsu and other things like that, where like, it's very obviously handcrafted, handmade, but that just again reminds you of how much time and effort and love had to go into making it work.
Yeah. Yeah. That's at the heart of Look Back. I would also say like the ending like really choked me up a lot. That's the part that really got me. And if you've read the one shot, you know, you'll know why. It is so much about looking back on how you grew artistically, like with another person next to them and their entire process. It goes well past their middle school and into high. They're in high school when they start making an actual manga together. But that ending is also harder to watch because, I mean, the character that causes the horrible tragedy to happen is also voiced. And he's terrifying in that
scene. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that must be... Gosh, especially, I mean, I can only imagine how hard it would be for the people in the industry, especially, you know, people that have connections to, you know, the real life inspiration.
Yeah, Kyoto Anime. Yeah, because, I mean, the plagiarism aspect that is in the manga that motivates that character, I mean, is present in the film as well, too. Like, so you hear him talk about that. Like say something about that, and
that
like,
honestly, that's making me feel like
yeah,
I don't know. It's like yeah, it's messed up. And not of the film. I think it's really honestly important. It's an important thing for this film to capture the how impactful and how awful and terrible that whole event was. Not on a human level, right? Not just on a broad abstract level, but you know, actually showing like the things that were lost because of that stupid senseless violence.
Yeah. Yeah. Thankfully, like there is some levity at the end to bring you out of that. And it does have like a, you know, the ending is hopeful. So it doesn't like just end on a really heavy note. I honestly feel like it was the perfect length. Like, I feel like if they had put more in there to like extend it longer to reach like, I don't know, 90 minutes or 80 minutes or something like that. I mean, they could have. It would have to have been like completely original or something. But again, like Yotaka Oshiyama, like he animated most of this movie, which is insane. Yeah. You know, the director storyboarded it, directed it, did the character design, did a lot of it. And he didn't, obviously it wasn't like solo, but this was like a very small team working on this film. I also wanted to give a shout out to the music. Haruka Nakamura did the music, and it's mostly like piano. It's not like super intense heavy piano, but it's not quite so light and tinkly. Like it has a nice medium there to it that feels emotional but also very like genuine and sentimental,
not like overbearing, not like,
no,
you know,
no,
feel things now.
yeah. And he did an interview with Montan Webb, So it's in Japanese, but I've seen some images that are being shared of the translation where he talked about how he had worked with New Jabez, who I don't know a ton about, but is a musician who passed away, and they worked closely together on quite a lot. Nakamura even said that working on this film about the creative process and everything also felt like it allowed him to think back on his own mentor and the person who, because he died tragically in like a, it was a car accident. That's, so it was also a totally unexpected sort of situation.
It's almost like the infusion of the human experience and all of the messy and painful emotions therein are necessary for something to be art. And you can't just AI your way into, I'm sorry, I'm sure you saw on Twitter making the rounds that dingus that put together the
oh, the AI Mononoke?
Oh,
I didn't watch it. Oh, I didn't watch it.
Oh, I was the upset that I felt at this chucklehead calling himself a filmmaker, having the gall to claim that Princess Mononoke is my favorite movie, and for years I've wanted to. Blah, 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 blah. Sir, do you know what Hayao Miyazaki would do to you if he were a younger and more able-bodied man?
Miyazaki hates him on principle.
He would he would kill you. He would murder you with his tools. I think what I said on Twitter, and this was
wearing the apron doing the murder. Yeah.
He would turn you into the freaking ramen that he makes for his his crew on days where he's forcing them all to stay over to stay over and work overtime.
Yeah.
I think I said on Twitter that Miyazaki would clown on you harder than he clowned on his own son. And I hope you realize exactly how sad and upsetting that would be for you.
I got more context about the Tales of Earthsea thing very recently that I didn't know.
Oh.
I guess, that was one of Miyazaki Sr.'s, favorite books. He used to,
I am sure Goro Miyazaki is a sweet man. He obviously is trying so hard, and I should be nicer to him, but Tales of Earthsea is genuinely an almost unwatchable film. And I can only imagine if someone did that, if my son made the Dark Tower movie starring Idris Elba and Matthew McConaughey, I don't even know if I would have the strength to be as calcitrant or as reticent as Miyazaki was.
I'm in a Reddit thread right now. The person I was talking to about the Earthsea thing told me that, I mean, other than the fact that it was profoundly influential on Hayao Miyazaki, but it was one of the first movies he attempted to adapt, but they rejected his proposal. This was early, very, very early in his career.
Oh, sure. So he didn't have the clout.
He didn't have any clout. And he asked if he could adapt it. And the estate was no. And so he went.
Didn't Le Guin only really give the rights because she thought it was going to be Hayao Miyazaki?
I think that's the popular story, is that now that he made a name, they then agreed to it. The person I was speaking with actually blames this entire situation on Suzuki, because Miyazaki, I think, was busy working on another film at the time. So they were in production.
It wouldn't have been Howl's. Would it?
It was Howl's. He was working on Howl. Yeah, that's what they told me, is that he was working on Howl. Yeah. And so he couldn't work on Earthsea. And I don't know. This is conjecture, I guess. I think that it may have something to do with, you can opt a movie, but you can't hold on to it forever.
Yeah.
And so I think timing.
Well, and there are rules about, you can only even retain the rights if you are actively producing something. A lot of
right.
Time. That's one of the reasons why what franchise was it? There's this one franchise, Hellraiser. That's why for years they kept making all those crappy Hellraiser movies, because they couldn't keep the rights unless they kept making, actively making movies. Even though they didn't really care, they just wanted to keep the rights for whatever reason.
Right. So I think that ended up happening, and so they had Goro do it. And that's
they couldn't have given it to Takahata. What was he doing?
I don't know what Takahata was doing.
Maybe would have made a great Earthsea. Maybe he was working on
Miyazaki will direct it.
Oh, so they were contractually obligated to have a man named Miyazaki direct.
Maybe. And so they were like, okay, well, we had Miyazaki directed. It's just Gorō Miyazaki.
I guess that would explain maybe why his architect son was suddenly like, oh, okay. Again, Gorō Miyazaki, he has made some better films, or he's made one better film. Up on Poppy Hill was pretty okay.
Yeah, that one was pretty okay, wasn't it? I saw that one in theaters and I didn't have any problems with it. Yeah, it was fine.
It was fine.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry, Gorō. You can animate better than me, man.
Yeah.
So
there is that.
Yeah, you can.
Yeah. And I mean, he's getting to work on theme parks right now. So hopefully that's a little
more satisfying. Honestly, that's sick. That must be super cool. I wouldn't be surprised if he's like way happier doing that.
Yeah.
Like he gets to oversee like he gets to be the Imagineer for me for Ghibli. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, you guys, if look back, you know, hopefully G-Kids releases it more widely in some fashion, whether that's streaming or on home video or more theater screenings. The one that I sat in looked like it was full. Mm-hmm. So, but it was in like one of the smaller theater rooms, but still, you know, the only seat that wasn't taken was the one directly next to me. No one wanted to sit next to Lindsay and watch Look Back. So whatever.
You should have been like, excuse me. I don't know if you guys know this, but I actually run the anime industry according to the commenters on my website. So I'm kind of a big deal.
Missing out on top tier behind the scenes commentary. I interviewed this man, but enjoy your film. So I say see it as soon as you can. I hope, again, that it becomes more widely available somehow so more folks can enjoy it because it was great. Oh, one funny little tidbit. This is one of the things that I like that they did. Fujino's Four Koma comic, they animate it.
Oh, that's awesome.
Her janky fourth grader art style. I just loved that. So anyway, all right.
Well, the good news, Lindsay, is even though I was heartbroken about missing out on Look Back, I could at least take solace knowing that when I got home, there was a brand new episode of Uzumaki to watch. And that would be something that could really lift my spirits and reinvigorate my faith in the industry.
Yeah. I mean, we've only been waiting for half a decade to see this four episode adaptation of one of Junji Ito's most famous horror works about a spiral wrecking havoc on a whole bunch of people. Yeah. I mean, we watched the first episode and, you know, it had like some pacing issues. Like it moved pretty quickly through its content to get to kind of the next thing. But, you know, sometimes you kind of got to like burn through stuff in the beginning to get to the good stuff later, right?
And that was honestly my hope, right? I was thinking, okay, they're burning through a couple of the the kind of signature early chapters so that they can, you know, because when I read that interview about them talking about, well, we had to rearrange some stuff to make it fit in the four episodes, I thought, okay, so maybe they are, you know, doing the smart thing and picking and choosing very selectively which specific stories they should, you know, dedicate time to in order to properly tell as complete little tales on their own in the span that they have to work with, which is not a lot of time.
Yeah.
It's not what happened.
No.
At all.
For those of you just tuning in, Uzumaki has just shit the bed. Shit the bed is probably the best way to put it.
I was talking with you off mic, and I think the last time I saw something take this much of a nosedive this fast was The Promised Neverland season 2. And that at least had a whole half a season to crash and burn into flames, where this is literally like someone flipped the quality switch to no good mode.
Yes. So I think part of the reason this makes me mad, and I don't feel like I typically get like overly attached to like entertainment things.
We know how it works.
We know how it works. So, you know, production issues, especially in this industry, is unfortunately very common. Mm-hmm. So it's not surprising to me when this happens. I think what maybe pissed me off the most, and again, this is also standard, so I may be unreasonable here, is that there was a large marketing push for this show. I mean, mm-hmm. it kept getting pushed back and pushed back, and we held out hope for it. And then, you know, once we got really close to the premiere date, there was a big marketing push, and there were interviews. We did an interview with Nagahama, there were interviews with Jason DeMarco, everyone, you know, and the worst that came out of those interviews, the worst inkling that something might be wrong is, you know, DeMarco did talk about how expensive this show was, mm-hmm. that, you know, it almost bankrupted them, that it was just sort of this nightmare situation because of COVID and things like that. And that affected a lot of productions. I mean, we saw lots of meltdowns in the after ripples of COVID. But I believed that because it got pushed back so much that they fixed it. Like it just, that's why it took so long, is because they had to fix all these things because of all these unforeseen events, right?
Well, and all of their marketing, and granted, I don't think there was ever any, I don't think they ever explicitly said this, but come on, marketers know what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, executives know what they're doing. And I would argue that very intentionally, the tenor of the interviews, of the, you know, even the production hell kind of aspect of the show, was that it was because we had to work so damned hard and so damn long to produce this. And they would, they would show us that first episode and the footage from that first episode. And again, in this industry, that's the kind of thing where it's like, oh, this is like a thief in the cobbler, you know, like a red line situation where, yeah, it was probably hell to make. We're never going to see anything like it again because the people who made it were probably insane to do what they did. You know, all the talk of like the triple rotoscoping on top.
They filmed it in live action and they rotoscoped it and mo-capped it and drew on top of the live action footage, you know, kind of like utilizing what happened with Flowers of Evil.
Yes.
But, you know,
the whole narrative
in, like, a bigger way.
The show is going to look like this because of all this stuff that happened. And then it doesn't after, you know, like, it, I don't think you're wrong for feeling mad, if only because, you know, I don't want to say lied to.
But that is how it feels, right?
At the very least, it feels disingenuous. It feels like Adult Swim is, they're trying to present their little masterpiece, knowing full well that it's a turkey, right?
Yeah.
After episode one. And, you know, we obviously don't know what 3 and 4 look like. And I think we were talking earlier that depending on how things shook out with the production, it's possible that there might be some shift back towards quality later on, depending on who actually got to work on what. But, it'd be like, what I said was like, it'd be like if Dune Part 2 was directed by freaking Brett Ratner and put out on Tubi for free streaming, right?
Yeah.
After all of that stuff, where it's like, oh, this is, we're doing it right. We're going to be the first ones to finally do it right. You know, don't look at all those, you know, those other ones sucked, man. But this is the real, you know, Frank Herbert Dune. And then they were just like, hey, we did the first part.
At least. Yeah. So to kind of get into the nitty gritty, I've been reviewing the episodes over on Anime News Network. So this is in my review of episode 2 that went up. Nagahama is not credited as director for this episode at all. And before people get confused as far as how staff listings go on anime, usually you have like the director, maybe there's a chief director, a director, and then there may be individual episode directors.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So the director is almost like the showrunner.
Yeah.
They oversee the whole production.
They oversee the whole, and there may be like an episode director that's really responsible making sure the pieces for that particular episode get put together. Right. Nagahama is not listed as director as of this episode. Now that's caused like some people to kind of catastrophize as far as like what happened behind the scenes. We don't know what specifically happened, why his name is not on it. It doesn't necessarily mean his name won't appear later on episode 3 or 4, but at least for like this particular episode, I would not credit anything you see on screen with Nagahama, because this is basically like this episode does not exist in his project. I mean, he on the first episode, he's credited not only as director, but he's credited with key animation. He's credited with like the head of the 3D CG department, and he did all the storyboards for that episode. So that was like, that is his baby as far as I'm concerned. Yes. I mean, obviously other people were involved in making it, but like he was overseeing all of that. You get to episode two, his name still appears on the storyboard. So you know that he at least drew the storyboards, but that's like, that's pre-production. That's something that would have been made before this went to...
Before anything even got rolling with the animation, usually in an ideal scenario.
Right. But after that, he's not credited. Instead, it is Yuji Moriyama, who isn't a newbie by any means. Moriyama's been in the business for a long time. Like, he worked on Dirty Pair and a whole bunch of other stuff. And then the episode director, sorry, his name's escaping me, but it's Heike something, who people are making fun of a bit on Twitter because I think he has somehow garnered a negative reputation due to his work on Tower of God season two, which, you know, which everyone I talked to, I heard sucks. Taiki Nishimura, thanks, unborn Borg.
Well, I was, and I mean, like you said, these are professionals and obvious, but the thing about this, and for those of you that haven't watched the episode, this isn't just like an example of like the three episode rule where, you know, episode four, oh crap, like they're clearly writing it in. There are cuts in this episode that aren't just bad, they're catastrophically bad.
Yeah.
Like they are
walk
they are,
cycles that are just like hilariously, like they're like three frames of
they, like they are bad to the point of this. It's clear it's not done.
Yeah.
The episode wasn't finished. Like this is clearly like gun to the head, you put out whatever you've got to fill the airtime because this needs to be finished.
So what actually happened, it's not even so much, I mean, that may be an element to it, but this episode was practically completely outsourced. So it wasn't animated by Fugaku, who animated episode one. And that's also a weird situation because when this project was originally announced, Studio Drive was supposed to be animating it. And their names were on the storyboards. But episode one comes out and is credited to Fugaku. So I don't know what even went on there, but that's already kind of a like, what's going on here sign. This episode was like, I'm talking key animation, the coloring, the in-betweens, everything was done by Phoenix Animation Holdings, which is based out of China. So this was basically entirely outsourced. I don't know the direct connection, but Phoenix Animation is in some way connected to the Okikubo-based studio Akatsuki, which has worked with Adult Swim and these production IG USA co-productions a couple different times. They did FLCL Shoegaze and Housing Complex C, and they also produced a animated segment for a Gucci perfume ad featuring Miley Cyrus. But they don't have a very long list. Like, if you go to the Akatsuki studio encyclopedia page on ANN, practically everything they do is like in-betweens and second animation. They don't do a lot of key animation and are typically not the lead studio, except for with these Adult Swim projects. It seems like sort of a go-to, or have developed a relationship with them in some way. But yeah, this episode was entirely animated in China. So it was shipped off for whatever reasons.
The quality control was not there.
No, the quality control was not there.
Although I will say something I was thinking as I was watching the episode, and obviously I don't know how faithful this episode is to the actual storyboards. Mm-hmm. I don't know what they had to cut or what they had to work around just to get the thing done.
Yeah.
Something I talked about in my preview for the preview guide, because I was actually a little harsher on the premiere than you were.
Yeah.
Even though the visuals, the atmosphere, superlative. For me, pacing is so integral to what makes horror good. We talked about this on the episode last week. And I really struggled with the pacing of that first episode simply because there was just no downtime. There was no time to be scared.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how successful this episode would have been.
Right. The script writer hasn't changed between episodes. That's consistent. And even if this episode looked amazing,
it's a mess.
Narratively a mess. Yeah.
Like, it's incoherent. Honestly. Yeah. Episode two is genuinely almost incoherent as far as we are adapting. For those of you that know the manga, we're adapting the Spiral Hair story. We're adapting, I can't even remember. Do we finish up the Jack in the Box Boy story? Or did
I mean, he's dead by the end of the episode.
But he didn't pop out, did he? I can't remember.
I can't remember his storyline, the most we saw is he got hit by a car and rolled up into the wheel.
Oh, so we start the Jack in the Box boy storyline. We have the Lighthouse storyline. We have the mm-hmm. Snail Boy storyline. Mm-hmm. We have the neighboring family, sad kids, romance snake thing storyline.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yep.
And all of them are running concurrently. Not just like temporally with the edit, but like in the universe of the story, these are all happening at the same time.
Yeah.
Which if this were a 45, 50 minute hour long show and you had maybe three runners, you know, an A plot, a B plot, and like a runner that would maybe go for two or three episodes, you could maybe get away with it. Yeah. But to have homegirl with the swirly hair be interacting with Snail Boy, and then also the Jack in the Box kid gets hit by a car while she still has her freaky looking hair. It's deranged. Like, it's honestly like it almost makes it feel like a parody where every horrible thing that could possibly be happening is happening at the same exact time. And no one is like
losing their shit, really. Yeah. Like, I mean, the crowd shots are so like lifeless anyway that it just sort of like you've got a guy who's turned into a snail who is like oozing his way all the way up the side of the school building, so you can like see him coming in through a window, and everyone's like, "Look, it's the snail guy."
Yeah, there was one really funny one. I can't remember what they were reacting to. Maybe it was the Lighthouse, but it's like a very obviously money-saving shot where it's just a slow pan of the back of people's heads. And then one guy just turns and goes, "Oh, what's that?" I laughed so hard because I was like, yeah, okay. That's how you react to what's happening.
Like, I said this about episode one. I was like, seems like they've really cut any semblance of personality out of Kyrie, right? And she also suffers a lot due to this, because there's no time for her to react or like internalize or like become anxious about any of it. It's just like, oh, my hair is being really weird. I guess I'll go to the hairstylist. Oh no, the hairstylist couldn't cut my hair. And it's just like cuts, and like she's back home, and then it cuts and she's going to school, and then it cuts. Like, the cuts are all really quick, and they don't mean anything as far as.
Well, because and the point for all these stories, one of the things that makes Uzumaki, I think, fun is that because the stories are all basically self-contained, you don't really have any plot lines that carry through until like the last quarter of the book, he can get away with doing a comedy chapter mm-hmm. in between a bunch of really serious chapters.
Right.
You have like two or three of the comedic relief stories like slamming up against the stories that are meant to be just genuinely disturbing. It completely kills the tone.
Yeah, because like the Super Saiyan hair fight battle, you're not really supposed to be scared about she's just wandering around school with her hair like that, and it's just absolutely nuts. But like the snail stuff should have been grotesque and like really gross, because I mean,
and sad. Like, that chapter is sad.
Yeah, it's like, sad.
This kid like becomes this horrifying thing, and it's like, oh no, this was like a kid like a little while ago.
And then then another kid also, and like I don't even know who that kid was, because like these characters are coming and going so quick. Like, they like name him off. So and so is a snail now too. I'm like, who is that? Have I seen that person before? But you know, it like, there's supposed to be this kind of like grotesque like mating situation between the two snails, and then the egg laying, and then the teacher stomping the eggs. Like, all that's gross. It's like, you know, body horror, slimy, crunchy, icky kind of stuff. And it doesn't really do anything. And even the scene at the end with the two lovers that are trying to run away together, we don't really get a good sense of why the parents are preventing them, other than generic Romeo, Juliet, our families don't like each other. There's no real reason. They just don't. But like them twisting together and then turning into like a sea serpent type thing and going into the ocean, that could have been freaky and cool. But instead,
that's one of the, for me, that was one of the images that always stuck out from the manga. But a part of what makes that particular chapter, that's one of my favorites, a part of what makes that chapter so powerful is because everyone else feels so helpless. They're literally just like watching this happen, and they're like, like, what can we do?
Yeah.
But when it's like in the middle of like eight other insane things that are happening literally at the same time, it's almost like, it's like, ah, who, well, that sucks. Anyway,
I guess they live in the sea now. Bye. Yeah. And now we're going to go climb a lighthouse that's full of burnt corpses. And the scene where they don't necessarily outrun the light, but then they're like impossibly falling. It doesn't really make any sense either, because it's been this like narrow stairwell corridor. It's like, you can't just fall. You just bonk your head eventually. And then
you would die. You would super die.
Super die. So it's just,
Have you guys seen the end of The Exorcist? It'd be that times five.
Yeah. There are some comments Jason DeMarco made, some comments on Blue Sky that have been deleted. So they're not, they do not exist natively anymore. Of course, they were heavily screen capped and shared online. I mean, they've been embedded in the Gizmodo article and some other articles at this point.
It's on IGN at this point. Like, it's
IGN. So like, sorry, bro. I'm going to show them real quick what he said on Blue Sky. Y'all can't read that, so I'll read it out loud. Was, it's fine. We knew this would happen. I can't talk about what went down, but we were screwed over, and options were A, not finish and air nothing and call it a loss. B, just finish and air Ep 1 and leave it incomplete. Or C, run all four, warts and all. Out of respect for the hard work, we chose C. After waiting so long, it makes sense people would be mad. Unfortunately, I can't tell them who to blame it on, but someone is definitely at fault here, and we all just had to do our best when things imploded. Maybe others would have made different choices. We did the best we could with what we had. But again, a lot of people worked very hard on this show, and I didn't think the actions of just one or two people should be the reason it never saw the light of day. Maybe that's the wrong choice. I truly don't know, but those people have a right to be annoyed and disappointed. I'm glad you are digging it.
I will say his comment there does not give me hope for the remaining two episodes.
Right. Yes, it doesn't.
Like, it sounds like maybe episode one was the only one that really came out as intended.
That's a possible interpretation. I don't know. I mean, I guess we'll find out. We'll have to see. People have been sort of like speculating about who to hold responsible for it. I'm not going to do that just because I don't know. I can't say for sure if it's the Japan side, the Warner Brothers side. I mean, I know there's a very popular villain on the Warner Brothers side, but I truly don't know.
And really, guys, I mean, I think one of the takeaways is, anime is hard to make in the best situations, right?
Yes.
In the best case scenario, it is still really hard to make. And also, the industry is, as always, in a very volatile place, you know?
Yeah.
When the money runs out, it is unfortunately, we're at the stage where it is just far too easy for the logistics of creating this huge production that involves, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of people, to kind of snowball out of control with there being nothing to do, right?
Yeah.
I think one of the, you know, something that DeMarco said, you know, was like, at a certain point, it's like, well, either we cancel it or we figure something out. And it sucks that the artists and the directors and everyone involved were in that situation, whatever the reasons were, whatever the cause was.
Yeah. I mean, James, if you had to choose between the three scenarios yourself, would you have made a different decision?
I mean, that's tough because I'm not, you know, I honestly think it would kind of, it might depend. I would honestly say if I was in a position of leadership and it was the work of, again, dozens, maybe hundreds of people, and it was, I don't know, that's hard. I would like to think that I would, you know, value the work of my employees and my comrades in the industry, and would be able to respect that and figure out whatever choice would best do that. Because there is also the flip side of, like, I mean, the downside of this is, you know, I know I was like ragging on Gorō Miyazaki earlier, but this is also an industry where, like, a bad impression can last 10 times as long as a good one, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I think, one of the questions I would maybe ask as a creative is this worth putting our name on if we are not proud of the results? But yeah. Then at the end of the day, you got to make money. You have to keep the lights on.
Yeah.
And sometimes you don't get that choice. Sometimes you have to say, I'm not proud of this, but I have to eat. And
yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I wanted to pose the question because I think it is very easy for people to watch this and just sort of, you know, kind of throw stones at it. And it's like, if you were sitting in that chair though, like, what would you do? I mean, this isn't even an A, B, or C. Like, I wonder if it would be at all possible to have episode one is like a proof of concept pilot and hope to like raise more funding to make the other three that way. But I mean, that is me not knowing anything about contracts involved and timelines and investments. And like, I'm not privy to any of that information.
I have long thought that, and again, just like you said, I'm not really privy to the number crunching of it.
Yeah.
I don't have that expertise, but I've wondered if maybe the industry overall would be in a healthier place if we maybe changed the paradigm for release. And that's tricky because this thing was in production for 5 years. So it's not
At least. I mean, since they told us about it.
But it's not like they were, you know, working on edits to the final cut the night before broadcast, like some shows are.
Sure.
But in general, you know, if we could find a version of this industry that could exist without necessarily being in that crunch, you know, time pressure situation, or being in a position where the only way to afford to complete something is to outsource it to, you know, cheaper, less experienced, less equipped studios. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Teo's offering that if they had done B, they could have seen the positive reaction pilot episode might have prompted enough interest to finish. I mean, that's true. That's a possibility. I do want to say, like, if they had chose to do B or A, people would have lost their shit. Straight up, if we waited this long for 5 years and they were like, we can't get this to the quality that we're comfortable with, we're going to air episode one, which you've seen all the highlights of over and over again in a bunch of trailers, so you've seen all the best parts of, and there won't be any more episodes, or just straight up axed it in the same way that like Konami did that Silent Hills game. I feel like people would still be mad for a long time. So I mean, I don't think there was a situation for this where people weren't going to end up pissed off.
I wonder, again, I mean, there's, you know, it's already done, but I wonder if it would have been maybe more financially viable to repackage it as a film.
Yeah.
To say, hey, you know, we can produce 70 minutes of footage, right?
Yeah.
We're going to have to cut some stuff. We're going to have to make some more judicious edits, maybe rewrite the script to fit that. Mm-hmm. But if we can make it into like a 70-minute film that can get some, you know, theatrical distribution, some streaming distribution that could potentially offset some of those funds, but then, you know, that's a whole different kettle of fish when it comes to licensing and all that stuff. You know, lawyers get involved. I mean, it's the entertainment industry kind of sucks in that sense. Like,
you can't just pivot.
No,
you can't just pivot. Yeah,
and really, the fact that anything gets made, even the bad stuff, is still kind of a miracle at the end of the day. So, I don't know.
So that's Uzumaki. We'll be here again next week and we'll let you know if it got any better, or if, you know, if it didn't, we may just say want in episode, you know, on episode three, but we'll keep touching in on that. Do want to talk about some of these new anime premieres that came out. The season has almost wrapped.
Yeah.
So I've actually filled in one day. If you head over to Preview Guide, there's a couple entries that have my name on it. That was weird. I hadn't done that in a while.
Back
in the trenches for a bit. So James, looking at Preview Guide right now, I feel, well, let's talk about the most obvious one because we're going to be talking about it for the rest of the season, which is Dandadan. So now that you've, you know, got to see.
Wait, crap. We're not talking about MF Ghost season two.
We're not talking about MF Ghost season two, or as Kennedy called it, we have Initial D at home. We're talking about Dandadan. So prior to its, you getting the screener for it, because we got screeners ahead of time. You didn't see it in the first three episodes in theaters or anything No, okay. So give me your full unfiltered take on the first episode of Dawn to Dawn.
Hell yep. Would be my my official review.
Yeah.
Great. I mean, it's everything I wanted.
Yeah.
It captured the characters perfectly. It had the kind of stylized, almost a point surreal sort of direction, color palette, everything that I thought would make the action and the humor pop. It's a lot for a first episode. Mm-hmm. And I think, honestly, if I had any biases, I think I could see people that don't know where it's going, that aren't just used to Dawn to Dawn and its whole shtick. I could see them kind of walking away from it going, what the hell was that?
Yeah.
But yeah. Knowing what to expect as far as the aliens and the Turbo Granny and, you know, everything that goes down, I thought it was pretty much everything I hoped for. I can't really imagine what I would ask to be done differently or better.
What you would ask to be done to Dawn differently?
Nah. the OP slaps so hard. And
it does.
My freaking head forever.
It does. The OP slaps really hard. It's very good OP. The sequence is amazing. I feel like all the voice actors are like spot on that mm-hmm. we've heard so far. Mm-hmm. For those who checked it out, and I'll be the first to tell you, there's some content in the first episode that is difficult.
Yeah.
It's in the manga too.
Audrey, a little body.
Yeah. It's in the manga too. I had a lot of people tell me, no, just give it a few more chapters.
It's very similar to Undead Unluck in that.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It doesn't ever really happen again. Well, in Undead Unluck, it does, but the context is so different. There's no sense of like assault or anything like that. It's completely different. And then Dawn to Dawn, it just doesn't happen again. Like Dawn to Dawn is not a fan servicey horn dog manga.
It's not. I mean, I saw some people like sharing some other chapter images completely out of context. There's like jokey nudity, but it's not salacious. Later on at all, there's not threat of sexual assault in that kind of way. It doesn't happen again with future villains and or creatures or whatever. So if you have concern about that, this is one of the few times I'll say, yeah, no, really give it like another episode and you'll be fine. Yeah. I really love the use of color.
Yes.
Which really just makes this whole show pop. You know, again, we're coming from a black and white manga, but it seems like they took some of the color design themes from the manga covers, which use that kind of neon, just highly saturated color palette. So it just looks amazing. Fonty5 says, I'm curious how he goes to the bathroom if his weenie is held by the granny. So it's not actually his weenie, it's his balls.
It's just the nuts.
Yeah. It can be misleading at first, but yeah.
Don't worry, they will remind you.
They will remind you.
You will be reminded plenty.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, we'll be talking about Dawn to Dawn going forward. I have something a little more in depth when we got two episodes to talk about, because I think the Turbo Granny stuff kind of comes together in the first two episodes.
But I mean, that's when you really get like the whole kind of conceit of like the transformation and the dynamic that they're gonna have. So.
Oh, wasn't his transformation cool though in this episode? It was really good. Really good. And Momo's psychic powers looked really cool too.
They did.
I thought they both got their moments to kick ass in the first episode.
I love the way they do her kicks.
Yeah. Oh, like kicks. When she like the kicked in the face and yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's important that they both get that because they're partners throughout the whole thing. It's not like Okarun's a badass who always saves Momo. They're both cool.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is a rom-com. This is 100%. They are adorable and perfect and good. And I need them to be married.
Ray Out brings up this other anime, so might as well just talk about it. They said, there's that anime orb, the movement of the earth that seems very Lindsay and James coded. Oh, you could not be more right.
Yeah, it was like... it was so funny. I'm blanking on the voice actor's name, but the guy who played the Observer from To Your Eternity is...
The Inquisitor.
The Inquisitor guy, the torture guy.
Yeah.
And he's using the same exact voice. And I just thought it was so funny that two orb related anime he's in, and he's a contentious figure in both.
Yes. Yeah, he sucks. I don't have a picture of him to show this time. This is the main character, Raffle. Or, mm-hmm. Not Raffle, like R-O-F-L. It's
Raffle.
R-A-F-A-L.
So no like, one's Raffling in this anime.
No one is Raffling in 16th century, 1500s, not Poland in this.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Well, come on. It's obviously the country of P.
It's the kingdom of P.
Okay. That just makes it sound dirty. The kingdom of the letter P.
Yeah, kingdom of the letter P. So Orb Movement of Earth, this is on Netflix. It's airing weekly. This is our main boy. He's an orphan who was adopted by a professor at a school, a teacher. He's planning to go into theology because that's what's expected of him. But really, he's interested in astronomy.
Yes.
And
the devil's math.
The devil's math, yeah. And the setting of this, now we had quite a few people in the comments let us know that the Inquisition wasn't really burning scientists alive and stuff, but whatever. The Catholic Church is the villain in this story, okay? And as far as
let's just be clear. Sure, did they literally burn people alive for saying that the earth is round? I'll be honest, I don't know. They burned people alive, though.
Yeah, it did happen, apparently not frequently. Because it was expensive to burn people alive, to which I say, yeah, okay, so they hung them.
Yeah, or stoned them, or just locked them in a dungeon and forgot about them.
Dropped them in a lake, I don't know. Yeah. So anyway, the Inquisition is this terrifying force within the kingdom, in that if you're caught teaching a heliocentric model, which is going against what the church in this story believes in, because they believe in the earth-centric model, because God loves earth the most, so of course put it in the middle. So if you're teaching that, you get tortured, and there's quite a few scenes, very graphic scenes.
Yeah, the show's gnarly.
It opens with a pretty graphic torture scene, like straight off the bat, like guys splitted another dude's jaw open. Mm-hmm. So
you got fingernails getting pulled.
Yeah, fingernails getting pulled off, all that kind of stuff. So learning this is dangerous in this story. And I've read the first manga. The manga is released in omnibus one. So they're like, it might even be three volumes in one. They're very thick.
Okay.
So I've read the first one of that and loved the manga. Thought it was really, really good. So we'll see in the next couple episodes, because it actually introduced like some Deuteron. Raffle isn't the only primary character throughout this. You get a sense of that from the opening sequence, which is also really good. So
good show. Good show.
Yeah. Yeah, if you like your fiction with some historical basis, definitely gives Vinland Saga vibes. So if you like Vinland Saga, yeah, for sure. What about Blue Box, James? What did you think? You gave Blue Box 5 stars.
I love Blue Box. I did. Yes.
This is also on Netflix.
Yes.
Yes.
It is. Just so freaking gorgeous, for one.
Yes.
Just a truly beautiful anime, but not, I would say, in a, there are a couple of moments that maybe go a little
heavy on the lens, guess, flare,
a little try hard, I guess.
Yeah.
But you know what, it's tasteful enough that I'm totally fine with it, right? They're not like slapping color filters on there like they're Gohans. And really what I loved about it a surprising amount is, you know, as I get older, even though I am a sucker for romance, and Teasing Master Takagi-san is one of my favorite anime ever, so I'm not I'm not above a story about cute kids falling in love. Mm-hmm. But specifically like the high school melodrama romance, it's just harder for me to just be fully invested in. I get kind of tired of it.
Yeah.
I'm much more interested in adult romance stories. I just find them more compelling. Unless there's like a specific angle or a fresh perspective that I haven't seen done 100,000 times. But as far as like the freshman and the senpai pining for each other for 12 episodes straight, and then eventually they hold hands, and you know, there's lots of hemming and hawing in between about what school am I going to go to, and should I pursue my career overseas, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
We've seen it a million times, but these kids felt so real to me. They felt so, you know, they actually felt like real children. I worked at a high school. I can sniff out when they're just being written like 25-year-olds that have been stuck in high school for too long.
Yeah.
They felt like real kids. They felt so likable. It's the kind of anime that could actually make me feel interested in the sports aspect, because I'm so invested in the characters, which I'm not saying that sports anime don't care about the characters. I'm not, you know, I'm not that guy, right?
Right.
You know, it's like saying, you know, it's a mecha anime that actually cares about the characters more than the robots. Like most mecha anime,
yeah.
At least in that premiere, the focus is so much more on just these kids kind of, you know, figuring out their feelings and getting to know each other in like a really organic way. You know, they're actually having conversations about, you know, what they like and what they're passionate about. It's just, it's like my platonic ideal of a coming of age kind of romance in this mode.
Okay. Yeah.
It's exactly what I look for. So I think it's awesome.
I liked it quite a bit. I think I wrote in my review though, that it felt a little like nostalgic, like they want you to be nostalgic for this particular type of feeling.
Yeah.
And I'm a little bit cynical about that, but I came around because I love this girl.
Yes.
A lot.
She is so great.
She's so great. Yeah. I believe her name is Hinako. I'll have to double check, but pink haired gymnast. And she's, you know, probably the romantic rival, if I had to guess. I haven't read the manga. But she's got romantic rival vibes and seems mostly there to just like get the main character's goat, which is good because you need someone who's like a little bit like that to add not animosity, but just
friction,
a little more friction and flavor mm-hmm. to a show, which is otherwise about two very nice kids liking each other. Yeah. And now they have to live together. So obviously that's going to develop further. Right. Yeah. Yon says her name's just, it's just Hina. So I just added a co on there for reasons, I guess. Short version of this, that story, like the main girl, love interest, she's an accomplished basketball player. This is like a magnet high school, junior high for sports, more or less. Like
she's like the star athlete amongst the star athletes.
Right. And her mom played on the basketball team with the main character's mom, and he plays badminton. He's also got a friend who just like does not care about his emotions at all. Yeah. So there's also that guy to just sort of be like,
balance him out.
So super, super cute. I didn't watch this one, but it got high marks from everybody on the team. I thought your review was particularly funny and that negative positive angler.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, I will be the first to admit this show is really damn good.
Yeah.
It's quite good. It was irritatingly good because I was so upset that I had to watch it. And it even goes out of its way to make its fish look even more uncanny and disgusting than it has to. It's horrifying. But it's about a terminally ill man who, content warning, makes an attempt on his own life. Like he is at rock bottom. He doesn't think he has anything to live for. And through a series of loan shark related shenanigans, he ends up falling in with a bunch of fisher folk who like fishing. It's a hobby. They're not, it's not their job. They find the beauty and the zen and the intrinsic joy of fishing. And even though main guy balks at it and, you know, isn't interested in making friends, he's really just trying to like kind of party out and burn out his final days, because as far as he knows, he has maybe a year or maybe two left to live. And but he ends up, you know, connecting with these people and kind of finding joy and finding hope. The character designs are really good. It's actually funny, like the jokes are good.
Yeah, and it's an original production by Studio Nut.
Yeah.
Also, they know that their name is funny. So like you can laugh at that if you want. Studio Nut knows.
I can't not laugh when I hear it. I know I was just talking about being like a mature, cynical adult. It's too good for the high school romance.
And then I'm like, nut. Yeah. I need to make time for that one. It's just, it's so heavy. It's a heavy elevator pitch. And it's like, do you want to sign on to watch this? I'm sure there'll be some intermittent, deeply emotional episodes in between shenanigans, and it'll be a great time. I just don't know if I'm gonna
I struggle with shows about folks with terminal illnesses, just because I feel like your options are either to cheap out and not you know, you're better and then you don't have to go through with that horrible inevitability, or you have to confront it head on, and that's just heavy.
That's just heavy, especially you get to a certain point in your life where those sorts of things just like don't seem so distant either. It's like Anybody.
I don't need the catharsis of the show.
Yeah.
It's something that we're living with. So.
Exactly. I think to round it out, there's like three magical girl shows this season, James, yeah. and you have to pick one.
Acro Trip.
Which one? It's Acro Trip.
Acro Trip.
Acro Trip. Why yeah. is it Acro Trip?
That show is so freaking funny.
It's really funny.
It's so funny. And I don't, a part of me doesn't even know why. There, it, are you've seen What Hot American Summer, right?
Yes.
Okay. So you know that that particular brand of that that strange combination of earnestness and we know this is the stupidest thing you could possibly yeah. be watching.
Yes.
This show is that, but a magical girl show.
Really?
Where I was taken so off guard by the show. It's another one of those, it's basically gushing over magical girls, except it's not going to put you on a list when you watch it.
That's getting a second season, by the way. Just throwing that out yeah. there for anyone who wanted to know.
I mean, you know, nothing against it. I'm just saying, like, that's one of the hurdles of watching that show.
Is yes.
that it's super horny about schoolgirl, magical girl characters.
Yeah.
This show is not super horny. It is okay. quite wholesome. But it's the same exact premise where our main girl is, she's kind of aimless and kind of listless. She's been moving around her whole life and she's never really been able to make friends. And she's very like a laconic, reserved person. And then yeah. the minute she sees our strawberry magical girl over here
yeah.
in like the little seaside town where her grandpa lives, her pupils get all cartoonified and she becomes a magical girl weeb. And she dedicates her life to being a magical girl fan. But she runs into that blonde guy she was just tied up with there in that screenshot, who is
yeah.
The strawberry magical girl's arch nemesis.
Yes.
And he's basically constantly trying to recruit her into evil because uh-huh. he thinks she would be the perfect protege. Yeah. And she's like willing to go along with it because she knows that without a good villain, her hero won't have anything to do. But the problem is that he's a deranged idiot. And okay. so he's more annoyed with his shenanigans than anything else. He has a pack of giant bears that are the funniest looking things that I've ever seen.
In what yes. world are these bears?
So
they look like Domo-kun.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they just say bear. Like, they're so stupid. At one point, he like grifts her into joining the Evil League of Evil. And it is presented exactly like a shady cell phone plan.
Oh, okay.
And he's like, yeah, I'm out of magic. I went over my monthly limit. But if you signed up, you could use the trial rate of magic. And then that could get us out of this shenanigans. And he has like a little pamphlet. Again, it's like I'm being accosted in Target by the Verizon yes. guys all over again.
God, I hate it when they do that. Segway, like that happened to me. I was in Target by a birthday present for a kid. And it was AT&T, though. It wasn't Verizon. Which, yeah. they just stop you midway. Hey, I lie. I just tell them I'm already with you guys.
Yeah. I've done that too. I'm like, oh yeah, I already got one. And they're like, oh, okay. And they know I'm lying, but they're not going to call me on it.
Well, how do they know?
So they're going to be like, pull up your phone, bro. And that's when I just run the other direction.
You're like, no.
Yeah.
Also,
Acro Trip, to be fair to folks that like their magical girls pretty, it doesn't look so great.
You okay. know?
It's clearly made on a budget. But like, it's one of the, when an anime comedy can make me laugh out loud, I'm already in. Like, that's a hard bar to clear. And yeah. it did it several times with its stupid. There's one bit where the grandpa and the evil guy are just laughing together.
Yeah.
And the girl like walks in on them. And the voice actor for the grandpa, or maybe it's the villain, I couldn't tell. But one of them is doing the most obviously fake bullshit laugh. Like, again, it's like when Paul Rudd like drops the dishes in White Hot American Summer, where he's just obviously doing the stupidest thing.
Yeah.
And in Acro Trip, the grandpa's just like, ah, ha 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 ha, ha 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 ha, ha ha ha. And I'm still laughing about it, to be honest.
It's just ridiculous. All right, we're going to close out on one more show because the people have demanded. James, how's the new Ranma?
It's great.
It's great?
It's awesome.
It's awesome.
Yeah, no, it is colorful. It's vibrant. It's got great animation. The character designs all look perfect. It's kind of doing that like halftone comic book thing that Urusei Yatsura was doing. Okay. So they're kind of riffing on that look. I thought it was awesome. My wife and I watched it together and we were laughing just over how nostalgic it felt.
Yeah.
Not just Rama, but just the style of humor. There's, you know, maybe a little dated for some folks, a lot of the, you know, pervert jokes, yeah, and a lot of the hashtag gender jokes that it's doing.
Yeah.
Probably hit a lot better in the 90s. It was like sipping on a mug of hot cocoa. It was like, yeah.
Does the first episode have the OP? Like, this is gonna sound weird, but like the hardest sell for me is actually replacing some of the, like, the opening sequence. The first one's really good, and there's quite a few ending songs that I listened to a lot in my teens that I just really liked that aren't gonna be in there.
We'll have to make the Lindsay cut where we just take the the Netflix episodes, but we cut in VHS rips of the original OP, like, not even screaming, but just VHS rips.
Yeah, I would also.
In the Puyo Puyo Mole Sauce, it is weird that they got rid of Rama's butt crack
and nipples. Yeah, it is nipples, weird. So, I mean,
especially because Netflix rated it TVMA, so I don't know why.
Why?
Yeah,
if it's Barbie dolls, that's why.
It's someone said that, I mean, that when it's airing in Japan, like, it's airing early enough that they're, you know, they're not going to put any nudity in there. But like, give us the butt crack cut, guys. Come on.
Like, this makes us sound like weirdos, but I mean, part of Ranma, I had the manga floppies as a teen as well. So, I mean, consistently in the manga and in the anime, like, nudity was just sort of a thing. And it wasn't like, woo.
No, it's not cheesecake.
It's not really cheesecake. I mean, there were some like chapter, the black and white, like, chapter cut pages.
Yeah,
like, you know, those can be kind of like pin-up-y at times.
But it's like, not like High School of the Dead. You know, it's tasty.
No, it's not like High School of the Dead. And I mean, but when you flip through it, like, if Ranma's boobies came out, it was just sort of, usually she didn't care because Ranma doesn't like have that modesty about his chest, so even when he's in female form, he didn't have modesty about, you know, his breasts either, so it was always very matter of fact. And it just felt natural in a way. For Steve, nipples were dots. They weren't in the anime. I mean, they were pink perky nipples, so yeah, I don't know what else to say.
They were nipples.
Yeah, Theo said Rumiko Takahashi was definitely my gateway to casual manga nudity as a middle schooler. Yeah, that was about the time that I read it as well. So
yeah.
So I mean, check it out.
English dub's pretty good.
The English dub's pretty good too. Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that about wraps us up for this week. Again, you can listen to the audio version of this when it goes up on Friday, and we'll be back again next week to see, you know, how Uzumaki is doing and how Don is doing, and you know, maybe we'll put some orb in there. I don't know. We can do that. It's gonna run for half a year, so
that's a lot of orb.
All right, everybody, we'll see you again next week. Bye.
The A&N After Show is an official podcast of Anime News Network. You can hang out with us live on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern on YouTube and Twitter. Listen to our podcast on Spotify or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. The A&N After Show is hosted by Lindsay Loveridge and James Beckett and is produced by Lindsay Loveridge.